I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. Buddy Guy was born in rural Louisiana in 1936. He made his way north and played with Muddy Waters and Junior Wells, becoming a key part of the Chicago blues sound in the 1950s. Buddy's influence on music and guitar players is massive. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2005 by B.B. King and Eric Clapton. He played at the White House for President Obama in 2012. I served as Buddy's road manager and sound engineer from 1992 to 2000. It's a great honour to have him on the show. Settle in for my chat with the legend, Buddy Guy. This morning I'm talking to my old pal and ex-employer, Buddy Guy. Good morning, Buddy.
Good morning, Frank. How are you this morning?
I'm fabulous. Listen.
Good.
I know you grew up in Letsworth, Louisiana, in a without electricity. But where, how did you first hear music back in your childhood?
Frank, where I grew up, there wasn't even any keyboards, no schools. We went to school in a church, and the first music, which a lot of gospel people were just singing with voice. There wasn't no instruments. So I would listen to groups called the Five Blind Boys, the Pilgrim Travelers. I could go on, but there wasn't no instruments in there until, I think that was the late 40s or something like that, they started with the keyboards and drums and gospel music. Because at first, Baptist people thought music instruments wasn't the right thing for Baptist kind of religion, you know. So I had to just listen to voices, and in church they would shout and clap their hands just by hearing people's voice.
It's well documented that a guy came through playing a guitar, and you were exposed to guitar music at that point.
No, well, we were so poor, Frank. They had one guy would come by every Christmas, which is about the only time my parents and grandparents, uncles and aunties would drink a case of beer or a gallon of wine was on Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's. And this, they would bring this guy to every house out in the country. Wasn't that many. And he had an old guitar. And when they would drink all the wine and beer, he would fall out to sleep, tell him to sleep it off, and I'd pick up the guitar and try to figure out what the hell was he playing, and I just fell in love with it.
And how old were you when you had an instrument of your own?
My dad first got mine. We didn't have the power saws and all that, and he was what you call logging, which is cutting timber. And it wasn't no such thing as a power saw. Albert King made a record about a crosscut saw. You took two men, if you know what I'm talking about. One pull and pull and pull. You pull, I pull. They saw the logs down. And finally, my daddy got one guitar from this guy with two strings on it. And he gave him a couple of bucks for it. And I went from there trying to make strings. I couldn't afford to buy a guitar string, so I would take, if I break one, I could take my mom's hairpin and bend it and splash it. And you know, I couldn't make no really thing, but I learned how to let my right hand know what my left hand was doing with that.
Yeah, and what year would that have been?
Frank, that had to be 1947, 8, or 9, because John Lee Hooker and them came out, I think, in 48 with Boogie Chillin'. So this got to be around 1947. I was born in 36. 46, I was 10. Around 1947.
The year I was born.
I was about 11 years old.
At least we're still here. moving on from that, so you learned to play by yourself, just picking out songs and learning the instrument without any formal teaching. Is that right?
Yeah, if I can understand you right, I had that one. We couldn't afford a radio. Finally, my dad got old battery radio, and you had to put the antenna on top of the house. And if it was cloudy or raining, you couldn't hear nothing. And that was one record, a radio station coming out of Tennessee called Randy Record Shop, and you could hear the Muddy Waters, the Sonny Boys, and them coming at night. I think it's around 9 o'clock. And it, not every night I could hear that, because the only night you could hear something is it was a clear night. The moon was almost like a break of day. You could walk at night by, and then I could hear the John Lee Hooker, the Boogie Chill, and the Muddy Waters, which is Rolling Stones, which the Rolling Stone named themselves after Muddy Waters' record.
What did you do for a living back then when you were when you got out of school?
Well, it wasn't nothing to do out there, Frank. This time of year, right now, you pick the you pick the cotton, plant your own potatoes, your veggies, and my mom could can the potatoes, the beans, or whatever we made. And then you go back, hope you could catch a fish or something like that, but. Wasn't much you could do, but as soon as I turned 13 or 14, then I could drive the tractor for $1 a day.
I did hear you once discussing with the late B.B. King. We were in an airport one morning, and you and B.B., I remember vividly, were talking about mules and plowing behind a mule in the morning.
I got familiar with the mule. Actually, I thought once, Frank, in my early days, just before 11, around 9 or 10, I thought a horse was a car, because that's the only time we didn't have to walk somewhere. You could ride your little ponies or somewhere like that. So, as you mentioned, B.B. came up the same way, Muddy came up. We all came up the same way down there. Because we didn't have electricity and stuff like that. We had what you call a lamplight at night. And they're using kerosene to burn the lamplight. And you wouldn't believe my parents were so poor. As soon as the sun went down and got dark, they all wanted you to hurry up and go to bed so they could save the kerosene, blow the lamplight out.
Yeah, it's a different life back then. Yeah, I remember B.B. Talking about the mule, and if the mule had gotten in the cabbage patch and you were walking behind it in the morning, it wasn't a pleasant smell.
Yeah, him and I went way back. I'm glad I met them all before they passed, because I learned a lot from them, but I didn't feel so bad after they was a bit older than me. I think B.B. was about 11 or 12 years older than me, maybe a few more. But when I found out how they had came up the same way that I had came up, wouldn't, and they were a little earlier than me, then I didn't feel so bad about the way I had came up, because I used to look at my parents and still think about them now. I don't know how in the hell they raised us. At what you just asked me, what did I do out there? Wasn't nothing you could do but farm. And in the winter time, you couldn't farm, so you would have to go hopefully catch a fish to eat this afternoon. Your mom had to open a jar of beans she had preserved in what you call canned goods, you know, and that's how we survived. We didn't have running water. We had to go to a creek and drink the water, and sometimes I think that water was better than the water we get in the city now, because whatever it had in it, I'm still here, so... You know, I looked at it that way, too, because when it rained, we was just the happiest place you could see, because that was really fresh water to drink, the rainwater.
Yeah, yeah. You must have had this thing in you, the idea that to travel and play music must have been in you at a very early age. When were you first aware of that, that you wanted... Well, you obviously wanted to leave... the village. And,
well,
and
there wasn't no school there. My sister, the one just passed last month, she was living in Baton Rouge, and they had a school there. So when I graduated from eighth grade, I went in there to try to go to school, and after I think it was 4 or 5 months, my mother taking a stroke, then I had to go back out there and start chopping cotton and driving the tractor again because I'm the oldest boy. And to help my dad with my younger brother and the rest of the family survive, because that's all we do. We didn't have all the technology. We got 9 jobs while people was making a lot of money. You eat to live and live to eat while I come from Frank, and that was it. You know, it wasn't my mom and dad ain't know nothing about no bank. If they had a dollar, they just pull it in the pillowcase on the bed, and you can leave the door open with nobody going in and take it. If they did, if a neighbor saw them, they'd point him and say, "You the one went in the house and did that." My parents, they never had a lock on the door of the house. From the time I left September 25th, 1957, until everything went crazy later on in life, because never, when he finally got old raggedy car, you didn't know, never roll the windows up until it rained. He never took the key out of the ignition, I guess, until you got rid of it, because you couldn't pay somebody to take your car back in those days.
Yeah. So you went to Chicago eventually. What sowed the seeds and triggered your desire to get to Chicago? I know work was involved, but were you aware of the blues and music scene there before you got there?
Well, and after I stayed in Baton Rouge for a few months, there was a guy with a guitar, the first electric guitar I saw was called. His name was Lightning Slim. And I had, the people in the South then were neighborly. You could walk by and it'd make you speak. They'd say, "Good morning or good evening." If you didn't speak, they'd turn around, put their hand on the hip and say, "I said good morning." So one of the guys had moved, left Baton Rouge and come to Chicago, and his ex-wife had got killed. And he came back and he told me, "Man, you could go to Chicago and work." I was working at LSU, the State University. He said, "You can go to Chicago and watch Muddy Water and them and get you a job at a university there, and you could watch them and probably learn how to play better." And I said, "You know, that's a good idea." And he said, "You can stay with me till you get able to get you a place to stay." And that's exactly what I did.
Hmm. Were you intimidated by Chicago when you got there, the big city?
Well, it was kind of strange because, you know, down there in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, it was just a weekend thing. You could go out on Saturday night and see people drinking a couple of beers Sunday afternoon, and after that, it was back to work. When I got to Chicago, I forgot what Sunday was because, man, you had people on the street Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. I said, "What the hell is this?" You know, because I had never been from the South, and from the country to Baton Rouge, I had never seen nothing like that. And I said, "My God, what is this? You know, when do people go to bed?" You know, it was most of the clubs were 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and you didn't have to pay no cover charge to see Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, or Little Walter. None of those guys, but they always making hit records, but they was getting ripped off.
Yeah.
And they was having just fun just playing. And I thought they was making a lot of money, Jimmy Reed. And I got to know them personally before they passed away, and I learned a lot from that.
When were you first aware of electric music and the amplifier? When did you get your first amplifier, and do you remember that experience?
I got an amplifier before I left Baton Rouge. There's a guy, well, everybody knew everybody. The guy even had a little music store. Because, you know, I was pumping gas, you know, and he let me have the amplifier, and I was paying, I think, notes about a week, every 2 weeks or something like that. But, and I brought that amplifier to Chicago with me. So I had that when I got there, but I wasn't here too very long before somebody stole all that, because I didn't. I'm like Chicago, and I can remind you, Frank, they call muddy water the mud. And they told me before I left Baton Rouge, they said, man, you got to be careful when you get there because, you know, you'll get mugged. And I went into a club and I played a couple of songs, one by Jimmy Reed and I think Guitar Slim. And the people were saying, I hadn't ate, that was my third day without eating. And I was just saying, I'm just hungry, man. I wish I just didn't eat a hamburger. And the people said, hell, man, quit jiving me. You can play that well. You ain't hungry. And I said, somebody called Muddy Waters. And I didn't know who he was. You know, I know about his records. And I walked out of the club, the famous blues club called 708 Club. And that was the address of the club, 708 East 47th Street in Chicago. When I walked out, I got slapped upside the face. And, you know, the friend was slapping my ears, was ringing, and the fans were saying, that's the mud. I said, oh, my God, I'm getting mugged. And I laughed at that Woody before he died, you know, and he bought me a sandwich and told me, don't think about going back to Louisiana. And from that on to me talking to you today, and I'm still here.
Yeah. The culture shock in Chicago must have been... you just said you got mugged, and it was a different kind of people were. It was a different kind of survival. What made you carry on,
Frank? You know, that's a good question. I don't get that asked for me too well. I don't know, because after I saw that neither one of them was making a hell of a living playing, and I got a job and started driving a tow truck. But I would get off the damn tow truck. I couldn't do it now. I was a young man, 21, 22 years old, and I couldn't wait to go by the club. And all, it wasn't no cover charges or no blues club back in those days. But you had to buy a beer, and if you want to sit in and listen to Muddy and them. So when I got the chance to play, and Frank, I used to play, and if I had 50 cents, then I got to know a couple of people, I would take the 50 cents and say, man, to get a couple of dimes and nickels and some pennies. I said, as soon as I hit my guitar, start throwing my pennies up here on this bar as a tip for me playing, but please get my dollar back so I can get me a hamburger when I'm finished. And that would start the fans that throwing nickels and dimes. And some nights I would wind up with $3 or $4. And that's what kind of made me stay here. That was my survival until I got that job driving the tow truck.
Did you play outside of Chicago much in those days? When did you start traveling and getting out of the Chicago club scene?
When I made my first record, 45, Sitting Crying, Sing the Blues, I went to, I think it was Alabama, and I didn't have no band. A guy would invite me to just come and play, and I went to Mobile, Alabama, and somewhere in Michigan. But in other words, Muddy Waters and them wasn't highly traveling then. We wasn't playing for white audience, but Muddy and them would go maybe to Alabama, Arkansas, or somewhere, maybe a weekend. 80% of the time they didn't get paid because the promoter had went in there this week and sold advance tickets and went in there just before the day they played and picked up all the money and took off and went somewhere else, and the promoter couldn't be found. You should have to talk to BB and Muddy before they passed about this, because I got this straight from the horse's mouth. You never found out who hired you back in those days. So I was getting my education from that. And I'm like saying, why are you guys playing? But they was having so much fun. And to be frank to you, not you, just to be frank, all I saw was if you played well, people would always buy you a drink. And if you played well enough, you could get you a good-looking woman. And that was the pay.
Yeah. I think a lot of people get into traveling on the road. I think that the good looking woman part comes in quite a bit, because if you're with the band, you had a little bit of mystery, and also you were usually leaving the next day, so people didn't have to put up with you too much.
Yeah.
So
they was having so much fun, it felt like they was getting paid, but all you woke up the next morning, if you took the drink, the fan would always buy you a drink. All you had was a hangover.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can't eat that. How was the segregation back then when you first started going out? Were you playing exclusively to black audiences pretty much?
99.9 to black. Every time you saw a white face come in, matter of fact, when the British started playing the blues, they started coming into Chicago, Paul Butterfield, Michael Bloomfield, when they would come into a club, if we had a 30 cents, I think a bottle of wine was 30 or 40, 50 cents, if you had, I said, man, don't pick up the wine bottle, not as a cop. And that was like Clapton, one of the white guys who was getting into the blues. And after I got to know him personally, became friends, we laughed a lot about it. I said, man, you made me almost pull my wine out. All you had to do, tell me you wasn't no cop, and we had fun. And they would tell me, all you had to do, tell me, because we wanted some of that wine you was drinking.
Now, at that point, when you started making records, did that change your audience, or were you selling records to mixed audience? No.
No, the British the one changed it. We owe them a lot of credit, Frank. Do you know they had a television show called Shindig, and when the Rolling Stones, they were trying to get the Rolling Stones to do Shindig. And Mick Jagger agreed to do Shindig if you let me bring Muddy Waters. And they asked him, who in the hell is that? And he got offended. He said, you mean to tell me you don't know who Muddy Waters is? And we named ourselves after his famous record, Rolling Stone. And that's when the white America, of course, white America knew it, but they was trying to keep this music from the young generation of the white kids. And then the first places we started playing were the colleges. And then the Chuck Berry and Fats Domino started coming on what they call Dick Clark Show, American Bandstand. And it was like the Chubby Checker, Chuck Berry and Fats Domino, but they wasn't playing Muddy Waters and B.B. King, and not that kind of blues.
Mm. When did that change for you? When did you make the transition?
I went to England, Frank, in February 1965, and I saw the change coming then. I went it alone. I didn't have no band. I played with the Yardbirds, and Rod Stewart was my valet man in February 1965. And I saw that there, and I came back here. The Chess record was a big record company, and they still didn't, you know, they had the Muddies, the Wolf, the Walters, and who is Buddy Guy? But finally, they find out that the British was selling tons of records with the guitars turned up like I was trying to get Chess to listen to it. And that's when the Leonard Chess called me in and said, I want you to kick me in my butt, because what you were playing, what we didn't hear, is making millions.
Yeah. And did you make any money back then from those guys?
No, I didn't start making no money, Frank. My first time I started making a decent buck was after I made Damn Right I Got the Blues, which I made that in London.
Yeah.
I came back and the blues was the college was paying us a little more than anything else. And we had the little blues clubs throughout the country, even out there where you at. When I first come to San Francisco, I wasn't aware of the hippies and Bill Graham and all that was out there. And I went out there, and while I was making $200 with my whole band in a van, $300, then it went to $350 or $400, and that stuck around for several years. until the British, like I said, helped us out a little bit. We went on tour with the Stones. And every time one of the Claptons or the Stones or some of the super groups would come in, they would take me or Junior Wells or B.B. King or somebody else on tour. And then that's when our name got bigger than what it was at that time.
Hmm. When was the first time you got on a plane, and how did you manage to afford that? Or did somebody front you the money to go to England? Or?
Well, the first flight I ever on a plane, they didn't even have a big airport yet, and they had one at Midway. And I think on my first little 45, I had me to come into, I think it was Mobile. And I was afraid. I still don't like flying, Frank, even before 9/11. But I got on that plane and went there. And that's the first flight I ever been on. And I don't remember the second one, but I know it had to come in there because we couldn't afford to buy no ticket on no plane. And after the British came in, the blues exploded with the Mudders, like I said, the BBs, the T-Bone Walkers, and I met T-Bone Walker in Europe. I met a lot of people, Big Mama Thorne, all of those people. I never did meet them here. I met them there. They had two guys out of Germany called Lippmann and Rao.
Yep.
And they had an American Folk Blues Festival. And that's when we started going to Europe and making a few more bucks than we were making here.
Yeah, I know those people. I worked with them in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you develop your sound technically with an amp? So whatever amp you had, you just had to plug in and make it sound. But to make it sound like Buddy Guy every night, that was in you. That was nothing to do with the amplifier and the sound systems. What are your recollections of sound systems back then when you started?
If I understand you right, Frank, I always did turn my amplifier wide open and I would use the volume on the guitar for, you know, more volume or less volume.
Yeah.
And when I felt like I should turn it up and blow you away, I did, and people were loving that. Because you had 1,000 guitar players here could play 10 times better than me. But the word got out, y'all better go see him because he's wild and crazy, which I had watched the late Guitar Slam and T-Bone Walker. And I said to myself, I can't play like these guys, but I think I can be a bigger fool than they are. And that's kind of helped me too. But I still was trying to watch those guys and learn how to play better.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're off the stage, you're quite a shy man, from what I know of you, but you get on stage, you're a different person.
Well, that's because I had learned how to drink the wine.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Now, did you notice coming up? Because I'm a sound guy too, and I'm always interested in the artist's perspective of when the technology got better and the sound systems and the clubs got better. Did you notice a difference, or were you just solely listening to what was going on stage, or could you hear what was going on in the room?
Now, you know, Frank, some people surprise me, the Claptons, the Stones, and everybody else, they look at me. This came out in a Rolling Stone magazine, must be 50 years ago. It was Jeff Beck and me, and they call us the Strat Cats. And they told me Clapton and Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page. When I went there in 65, they said they didn't even know a Stratocaster could play blues till they saw me, and they all went bought a Strat after that. But I didn't pay attention to what I was doing. I was just trying to get attention. I said, I can't play like these guys. They're better than I am, but I want to get attention. And I was doing all this crazy stuff because I heard Eric Clapton say, I don't remember that. I threw the guitar up and caught it coming down, and I didn't miss a note. And I don't know nothing about that because I found it full of wine then. I don't even remember catching it.
And of course, I think down the road, when you started getting a bit of money, did you have more than one instrument? Did you have more than one guitar and get a better amplifier?
Well, after I made a couple of records and the word got out that I wasn't as bad as I thought I was, that's when the Guild Guitar People and my first Newport Jazz Festival came up and said, I want you to play my guitar. I'm going to give you guitars. And I thought it was joking. And that was my first endorsement. And then later on, I think they went out of business, and that's when Fender came along, and I didn't have to buy no more guitars. I said, oh, my God. This has saved me a lot of money. I don't have to buy no guitars now. And then the guitars, the strings people came up and started giving me the free strings, the free guitar picks. And I started thinking about how poor I was. I'm saying, how come y'all didn't give me this when I couldn't afford to buy it? And I look back now on young people who can't afford what they won't give them to them. But guess what? I give them to them.
You've been very generous with young people coming up. I've noticed that about you. And in the early days, too, you had a band in Chicago. Would you just pick up a different band every week or whoever was available? Or did you have regular guys with you?
No, I always liked to keep my regular guys because the type of playing I was playing, Frank, was like crazy. I didn't know what I was going to do next. And if you got two or three guys been with you for a year or two, they know exactly what to expect out of you. You got to keep your eyes on me now, because I don't, you know what? If you would call me in the lift saying, like I see some of these big super groups do, I can't even follow my own record, because I'd be done goofed up on that, man. I say, you got to let me do it the way I'm going to do it right now, because sometimes, especially in Europe, when I had my first big record was Damn Right I Got the Blues, and the guy come on, wanting to play it. I said, man, you ain't going to get it like I made it, because I can't even do that no more. And even B.B. King would tell me that. You know, he said, don't feel bad, I can't. See, I can't do it exactly like I recorded that no more. So then that made me feel a little more relaxed getting that kind of information from him, or Muddy Wolf, all those guys who had made hit records.
Yeah. Yeah, the difference between the studio and playing live, you know, some people try and recreate that. You can't. The studio is a different animal. And thinking back to the time I was working with you, I never saw a set list. I'd go in and we'd be doing something, and a journalist would come up and say, "Do you have a set list?" I said, "Go ask Buddy," because there was never a set list. It was
no. I don't care a set list. I kind of listen to my audience. You know, I can be on stage and I can hear somebody mention a song, and they might have didn't even think I heard it. And I said, I had forgot. Let me try that song. And I don't even let the guy know you the one that calls. I sung that song. I just heard him talking between songs. Some people would say something about a certain song. I say, I forgot to do that. And that's what make me no different. I ain't never had a set list in my life.
Yeah, I was when I first got to be working with you. I was working with John Campbell and your Scott Cameron, your then manager, asked me for my phone number, and then as fate would have it, a couple of months later, Campbell passed away, and Scott Cameron called me up, God rest his soul, and said, "Are you still available? Would you like to come and work with Buddy Guy?" And I thought, oh, of course, I didn't even think. And we had some very good times, Buddy, on that road.
I had some good times, man. I still laugh at some of the things we did. Some of them was funny and laugh about it. I your name be mentioned a lot every once in a while now, man. Because I can think of some of the things we did that had to make us laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what kind of keeps a blues musician going, you know. Like, as I said earlier, I learned from B.B. and Muddy and them. I didn't go through the stuff they went with. B.B. King has said and told me once, you know, that, like I told you earlier, the promoter would pick that money up today and he played tomorrow and going on to the next town. And B.B. said he was went into play and found out he didn't know where his money was, so he said, well, I'm not going to play. And he walked outside, and the fans was chopping his bus with axes, you know, knocking holes in the bus, say, "You got my money, and you going to play." And he couldn't explain to him he didn't have the money. The promoter had took the money and ran away.
It's not an easy life on the road, but that humor is what you have to have, I think, to get through. Because we went all over. We went all over the world.
I don't forget nothing like that. I've seen, I've seen some days we caught hell, and I've seen some days we always laughed.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And getting back to the no set list, and your band, I was just amazed that you would start a song and they would just follow you, like they. You'd play two notes and they knew what was coming. And they would all be looking at you because to get a clue of what was coming up next. And I think that spontaneity is missing in music these days. I think a lot of it is just too formulated. You know, everyone knows exactly what they're going to play at exactly the same time every night. And they can't jam.
Mm-hmm. Because, Frank, I remember I was playing this before I met you. I was playing at Stanford University there in California. And James Brown was making a hit after hit, you know, and I was playing. The students had me play that night, and I said, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't have my band as tight as James Brown. And them kids looked at me and said, yeah, when I go see James Brown, it's like a sewing machine. But when I come see you, I don't know what to expect, and I like it like that. And I just say, oh, my God, I better just keep doing what I'm doing because I can't be James Brown.
No. And why would you want to be? Because you're Buddy Guy. And that's the beauty of because you came up, the influences you had were very limited because of what you were able to listen to. So that must have been in you. You know,
I'm self-taught, and I think I get so nervous before I go to the stage, and I don't care where it is, I've been in the White House, I can't dream of being there, and I've been played some places, I just close my eyes and say, how in the hell did you get there? And when I get there, I'm nervous, and then, as I say, I take a shot of cognac and say, just go out and do what you do best, and if they like it, they take it. If they don't like it, you give. You know, my dad, I wrote a record. My dad told me, in his good health, and he didn't just tell me, he told all five of us, don't ever be the best in town. Just try to be the best until the best come around.
Mm-hmm. That's wise advice. Wise advice. And these days, what are you? You're obviously with this COVID thing going on. We're in 2020. Nobody's playing live. Are you missing it?
Yeah, you miss it. You know, I used to could jump off stages. I can't do that no more. And if I'm answering you right, I just still give the best that I got. And that's all you can do. Because who I was talking to, matter of fact, somebody was asking me about an interview. I think it was 5 or 6 months ago, they said, we got to get somebody who know you can tell me about you coming up. I said, shit, you got to go to the graveyard to get that. Ain't nobody living. Not another musician can talk about me, about what we went through, like me and you talking about now. Mm. You know, you can count the ones left. You know, I was talking to Bobby Rush a couple of nights ago, and he said, man, you know, you're telling the truth. Ain't nobody left now in the 80s, Holly, but me and you.
Yeah, when Scott Cameron pulled me in, and the first show I did with you, it was the BB Blues Tour, BB and Buddy, and I think the Alligator All-Stars were on that, Junior Wells and Coco and Lonnie Brooks, and you sent me to Junior Wells' dressing room saying, Mr. Guy, you said, Frank, you go to Junior's dressing room and tell him I want to see him. And so I go in and I say, hey, Mr. Wells, Mr. Guy would like to see you in his dressing room. And Junior pulled a knife on me and said, "You tell that motherfucker if he wants to talk to me." And I thought, this is my first day. This is my first day. And I didn't know Junior. I didn't know he was jiving. You know what I mean? And or your history. What, I mean, that sounds like... it sounds like... I thought, did Buddy do that on purpose?
Them are the things I miss, Frank. You know, the young kids can't make you laugh like that no more,
oh,
man.
No, you don't
have that no more, man. And I miss that like hell. Some nights I'll be laying you, especially since this pandemic is going on. I lay you some nights and say, "Why did yesterday go, man?" Well, we could just laugh at some things. And the laugh made you forget about the time that you were kind of upset or angry or something, but all that's gone now, and all you can do is do what we do now, and great people like you and myself and one or two more is still around. The rest of them is gone away.
You never know the minute, so.
No, so we got to enjoy life while we're here, Frank, because tomorrow ain't guaranteed.
Yeah. Well, I remember someone was talking to you about the glamour of the road, and you made the point that, hey, if we get a little bit of Chinese food at the end of the night, that's a good day. We're happy when we get off the stage and can get a bite to eat, you know?
Yeah.
Because sometimes, some nights, sure, we were in places where we couldn't.
Yeah. That's for sure, right?
And you taught me one thing, Buddy. You always had a little bag with some kind of food in it with you, wherever you went. And I still do that. And people go, "Why have you got that?" I said, "Because you never know where you're going to end up on this road."
That's for sure. That's for sure.
I always have a little.
And that's the hard way. I didn't, you know, there's another great guitar player, Frank, named Earl Hooker. And they would go. They didn't have much money. They would have old station wagon. They would fill the car up and drive from here to Mississippi and play for the door. And they didn't have hardly money to get back. And they would be on their way down there, and they would tell me they would stop while the black people were working in the cotton fields and whatever. They was driving tracks, and they'd stop and say, "Hey, man, when y'all get off this Friday night, we're playing down here at this little country club, say you can come in," and it was 25 or 50 cents to see them play. So they had one keyboard player, he couldn't read or write. And this was in like mid-July, August. The temperature already was 95 degrees, and the keyboard player had a coat, you know, like almost like an overcoat. And they had, I think he said he had 60 cents left, so he said, "Now we're going to go in this one-horse town little store, and we're going to buy a soda water and a box of crackers, and Cookie, you go over there and steal the potter's meat and the Vienna sausage." And Cookie couldn't read. He went in the dog eye. And he's picked up some Alpo and Rival and cat food and put it in his pocket. And say when they got about 60 miles away, they stopped at this big tree and laid out in the grass and said, "Come on, man, bring the sausage and stuff out so we can eat, so we can hurry and get on here and play." And say when he started pulling it out, say one can, say Rival, and the other one say the Alpo, and the other say some kind of cat food. And I said, "What did you do, man?" He said, "Did you ever smell that Alpo when you first opened the can?" I said, "No." And all these things like this used to make me survive by saying, "I can't do nothing but laugh," you know.
Yeah.
Because this is so funny. And this is true. They would tell you the truth. They wouldn't be laughing.
Yeah. But in my time with you, though, I noticed that the respect level and was going up, especially after that. Damn right, I got the blues record, but it's a hard sell because you didn't get the radio play, you didn't get pop radio music, you know, you didn't get.
Well, we still don't get that, Frank. And why is that? I do not know. You know, I don't ask some disc jockeys. I've had disc jockeys come in my club And I said, buddy, I ain't seen you. I'm from Portland, Oregon, wherever. So you ain't had nothing out in the last 5 years. Now, any time a disc jockey, at least if they didn't play the record, they know you had one out. So I don't know what's going on with that now. Before BB passed away, before Muddy passed away, all the guys I could question about that, they couldn't answer about it. So I don't know what it is. At once I thought some of the lyrics and blues was pretty strongly for a kid 7 or 8 years old. But when hip-hop came out, I said, no, that can't be the case because they sang stronger things than we sang. Because the song several people made about it's a dirty mother for you, they said that was too close to the real thing and they wouldn't play it. So I said, maybe I should record that and I say the real thing. I might sell a few records.
Yeah, you should. Well, live you did, but we could use language on the stage that you can't use on the record. That's
right.
So what do you? You made a point of that not having a set list in relation to people not being able to jam, and with these electronic instruments, they're programmed, and a lot of kids, well, a lot of young bands coming up can't jam. They don't, and it's going to be even worse now because they can't even get together physically in one place. What do you see as the future of music, or do you even care?
It's kind of scary. I'm 84 years old. It's kind of scary for the blues to stay alive. I recorded Quinn Sullivan, and he tried and he switched now. I think he's trying to get into the type of music that they do play on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't hear too many young kids now, and because most kids look for role models. If I hadn't heard Muddy Waters and B.B. King, I don't know if I'd have been playing guitar, but I heard the John Lee Hook and all those people like that. And that's what led me into it, because the AM station, wasn't no FM station when I picked up my guitar, it was the AM station. And Frank, the AM station would play a gospel or jazz or blues or whatever was out there. And they didn't have no program director that this guy could play whatever he wanted. You could take a demo tape up there, he would play it. And nowadays, you don't hear, I don't think you hear much of Eric Clapton blues no more. The television station, we got Music Choice. And if you go through there, and 99% of the time it's hip hop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember you were always encouraging young Johnny Lang when he was 15. We'd have him around, and you'd always invite young people up. And I think the blues will survive.
I hope so, Frank, because we got a little black guy I recorded out of Mississippi called Kingfish. He won a few awards, and you can hear, like I say, on satellite. But some people with their kids who probably can help us out with that a little bit. Their family can't afford satellite because you got to pay for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no more free, nothing free no more. Like I tell people, when they call me on this phone, well, that's a listener on the phone, I'm going to do this. You ain't going to do nothing for me, because I said, when I left Louisiana 63 years ago, water was free. You can't even get free water now. So shit, don't call and tell me you finna give me nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I got
you. And if that ain't the blues, what is?
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
All right, and again, say hi to your family. Give them all a big hug.
I will indeed. I will indeed. And I'll be in touch.
And thank you.
Thank you, buddy. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for plugging in. We can't do without you. And if you can, please consider supporting the show so that we can keep it running through 2021. Go to our website at soundmanconfidential.com to find the link and to check out our amazing upcoming guest list. If you haven't already, plug into previous episodes with the 4 original Talking Heads. What other podcast can claim that exclusive? Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black with our team, Chip Bentley on sound production, web design, Addie Bell, original music Paul Westwater, and public relations, Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.